In the first part of our conversation, Stephanie McMahon showed us how research can move into practice through sustained partnership, educator agency, and inquiry grounded in context. In the second part of the conversation, she takes us inside the design of learning environments themselves, especially the shared sense of connection she calls social synchrony, and the ways educators can build it deliberately. Heard alongside Zaretta Hammond's cognitive apprenticeship, social synchrony gives us another way to see how connection, trust, voice, and shared participation create the conditions for deeper learning. So let me go further now and talk about that precious but scarce commodity, time. Let's begin. Stephanie, you made a very strong and I think important point about affording teachers the opportunity to experience the joy of deeply thinking and deeply meaning-making and thinking big. Both from your experience when you were working full-time in the trenches, as well as now as you go in and out of schools, what are the sort of things that could be jettisoned so that teachers could have more time to be doing what you're talking about?
It's a very tricky question because every school context is so different. And the way that schools approach time allocation can be quite different. I think if we're wanting to inspire and invest in our educators as agentic, creative, innovative thinkers and pedagogues, then we need to perhaps start with where can we create more of that space? And then thinking about what can be shifted in order for that to happen. And I guess some of the things that could be shifted, maybe it's tricky to kind of, I guess, really narrow it down to specific things, but obviously I'm thinking administrative burdens. I'm thinking on the tip of my tongue was going to be things like playground duties. But at the same time, I think some of those experiences are really important for building relationships outside of the classroom. So I think it is a difficult question, but maybe it's also about thinking about how much time do we invest in professional learning and what does that professional learning look like? And have we considered ways to, rather than structure professional learning to be very prescriptive or very one-off, are there ways to invest in that continual deep learning over time? So even starting with the allocation of professional learning time, how can that be more about the deep learning and less about perhaps the housekeeping that might exist within a faculty or within a year level or whatever the context is? But I don't know if I've answered that.
I think that actually, I think that's a good answer, both in terms of being explicit about the fact that it will be different in every context, but then taking an example that people often think about as professional development, but when you interrogate what's going on, you see an awful lot of business taking place as professional development. Mm. And then we finally get to the interesting sessions, often at the end of the day when we don't have enough time. And so I think that's a good example. The idea that I just had listening to you as well is if we really respect the teachers as professionals in their agency to enable them to be able to identify continuous improvement perspective and a ground up perspective, what are the things that might be put aside or eliminated that would not affect the quality of their interactions with students, but would contribute to deeper meaning for them and more profound impact for their students?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's a really important point that you raise around bringing teacher agency back into the conversation. Where are they placing their value, and where do they feel like their value is being recognised and heard? And that continuous growth and continuous opportunity for deep learning. What we have seen in our work in this in within this with schools, but also in industry, has been that people want to master their field. People want to learn deeply, and they want to be able to contribute purposefully in their workplaces. And that creates a wonderful sense of motivation and connection and a sense of belonging and meaning in their workplaces. So I think that is a really important way to perhaps reframe where do we find this time.
I want to talk a little about the work that you've done that focuses on social synchronicity and the texture of connectedness. Your 2020 study that you did with Anne Marie Carroll and Robin Gills identified four conditions for social synchronicity in classrooms: familiarity, affect, competence, and student voice and choice. As I think about that, it really gets very close to what, in another part of this podcast, Zaretta Hammond calls belonging and intellectual safety, that she sees as so key to deeper learning. And what, in still another part of this podcast, Kimberly Schonert-Reichl explores as the relational climate of a classroom. How do you see social synchrony relating to those ideas? And what does your research add about how it can be actually built and sustained day to day?
So this particular research that you're talking about was my PhD research, and it was built from my own curiosity as a teacher and a leader within schools about how connection happens in the classroom. And in particular, how you capture that vibe that you feel when you walk into a space. And I used to visit a lot of my classrooms of my staff, and you could go into the room and you could get a sense of the level of connection of students in that classroom. You could sense the vibe. Sometimes it was fabulous, and sometimes it's not so fabulous. So I really wondered, A, how do we create that? And is it just an intuitive thing that some teachers do and some don't? Or is it something that it can be learnt and developed? And B, is it important? Is it important for learning? And so my PhD was around this idea of how do teachers create connections with their students, between their students, and between their students and their learning. And it was during that work, and I was using the science of learning as a lens to think about this from that kind of interdisciplinary perspective, that I came across this construct of social synchrony, which I'd never heard of before. But it describes this sense of this shared sense of connection that can occur across groups, and that it is evidenced not just behaviorally in synchronized behaviors, but it's also evidenced emotionally. It's evidenced through shared thinking, and it's even evidenced neurologically through shared brain states and physiologically. So it's this kind of, I guess, this capacity for a group shared state that could be leveraged for good or evil in many ways, but I'm very interested in leveraging it for good.
I'm glad.
Yes, definitely. So, looking into this construct a little bit further, it aligns with a lot of other psychological theories and ideas around in-group and out-group connection, that we tend to more innately synchronize with people who remind us of ourselves. It underpins things like our capacity for empathy and perspective taking. So, recognizing the power of this incredible force, I felt that it was really important to understand how can we engineer it? How can we build on this capacity, this innate human capacity that we have to connect with others like ourselves, or to connect with others regardless of who they are or where they're from? How can we capitalize on that to build a greater sense of empathy and connection and engagement to enhance learning. And I think it has very strong, it does have very strong alignments with the capacity for creating those conditions for learning, because it is about building a better understanding of what do we have in common with others, and doing that through building relationships and conversations and trying to break down those cliques that might naturally occur within school contexts or different types of educational professional groups. So we, as humans, we fundamentally have more in common than we have that separates us, but we do tend to subconsciously tap into those perceptions of things that we feel are more similar to us. So the idea of social synchrony within a learning environment is how do we build the capacity for our students and for our teachers to recognize more of those similarities and to create those capacities to be connected with more people than we would normally just perhaps associate with. And it really comes down to fostering relationships and having conversations and engaging in active perspective taking and active listening of with others. So making opportunities really explicit, or providing opportunities and being very explicit, I should say, about connecting with others and engaging in empathic conversations with others or empathic interactions with others. So we're creating not just emotionally safe spaces, but that we're creating environments that foster interpersonal curiosity and wonder and interest that help us to be and help our students to be more open to different perspectives and different ideas. So I think this notion of social synchrony is incredibly powerful for us to understand as being both an unconscious and a conscious process. And thinking about it as educators and engineers of learning environments, how can we be using this in a way to create this sense of connection within the learning environment? And this idea around, like, even though I did this work in year nine classrooms, being that year nine is generally the point in that schooling career where our students feel least connected in their education. But my learning through this work around social synchrony and the power of relationships and the power of helping people to feel familiar and connected, and to experience positive effect, and to believe that they're competent and that those around them are going to help them to be competent, and of giving people a voice, has now really permeated through all of the work that I do. So it's very much this notion of human connection and learning, of bringing that lens of social synchrony into the work I do with educators and leaders, the work I do with industry, the work I do as a teacher in university contexts. It's about building those spaces where people feel connected, not just to those who they would innately connect to, but feel connected to everybody, and creating that sense of, I guess, that positive vibe that enables thinking and feeling and meaning making.
I would imagine that there are some people who listen to this who really grasp what you're talking about and its importance and want to know how could they do it. And so I invite you to take one or two examples from, it could be from the earlier work, it could be anything else you want that just shows what this looks like in practice, in what you have done.
I think there's lots of different ways. If I even go back to my framework of familiarity, affect, competence, and student voice and choice, the notion of familiarity is, I guess in some ways it can be around having structures and routines and ensuring people, if I've got my students, my university students coming into a course or into a classroom or into a learning experience, they know what they're going to expect. They know what's expected of them. They know there's clarity around the structure of the learning experience. But the notion of familiarity is also familiarity with each other. So providing opportunities to get to know the people that are your elbow buddies or the people you're sitting at the table with, but also lots of opportunities to get up and move around and meet other people and hear other perspectives. So interactive tasks where people are having to engage in conversations with others. And this could be not just within a student learning environment, but within an adult learning environment or an adult working environment. How are we facilitating opportunities for people to have conversations and become more familiar with others in the room? So that's the notion of familiarity. The notion of effect is around how can we be creating those conditions where the dominant emotional experience is of a positive effect. And that doesn't mean laughing and being joyous all the time. It can mean being curious. It can mean being confused and puzzled, but knowing that there's going to be avenues through which that confusion or that puzzlement will be resolved or explored. So it's reducing those strong negative emotional states like fear or distress or anger, and really trying to look for ways to design learning experiences that provide opportunities for people to feel good about learning and being in that space. And that can be through using a little bit of humor, or it might be using thought-provoking group discussion questions that allow for people to share ideas or to struggle with complexity. So that's the notion of effect. The notion of competence is recognizing that everyone in the space has something to offer to build that shared knowledge. The notion of competence in my PhD study really came out from the students saying to me that they had an expectation that their teacher was competent, that their teacher was capable of helping them to learn and helping their peers to learn. And I think that's a really important point for us as educators to remember that our students do come to the learning experience with an expectation that you're going to teach them something, that you're going to equip them with something, that you're going to build their capacity, you're going to cause them to think and feel. And so ensuring we have opportunities for people to shift in their sense of their competence themselves, but also to see that others are contributing to that shared competence building. And then that final dimension of my framework was around student voice and choice. And this can be teacher voice and choice or frontline worker voice and choice. It's about ensuring that people have a way to contribute to this conversation or to the thinking or to the development of that shared knowledge. And that might be through asking questions, but it might be through capturing their ideas in a digital space, through a blog and a discussion board post. It might be on post-it notes or up on the wall. Lots of different ways of capturing people's voice, but ensuring people feel like they have something to offer to the conversation. So, all of those, when we think about those four dimensions of my framework, and we think about the science of learning, we can see there a very active, embodied experience of learning that places humans at the center and the human experience at the center of that learning experience. So that to me is how there's some of the ways in which I think you can enact that in practice, whether it be in a classroom or whether it be in a professional learning context.
Great. I want to now draw on another piece of your work because you're not only working in schools, but you're also working in industry. And I want to draw on what you have been learning from your work in the mining industry. One would think that's a very different setting than the school. And mines are high-risk environments. And you've been looking at supervisor competencies and thinking about what good training and support would be to help people develop those competencies. What has your work studying adult learning and development and applying it in this context led you to bring back to K-12 education?
So I'll start by giving a little bit of context to this rather random offshoot of the work that I do. So this came about from a couple of years ago. The mining industry approached me about the work that I was doing in schools, and they'd heard about it along the lines through someone that they were related to or something. I'm not really even sure how it came about, but they came to me with a problem of practice. And their problem of practice was that mining is a very high-risk industry, as you mentioned, and workers are trained at the start of their engagement in the industry on the particular operational tasks that they're involved in, and then continuously trained as needed as they progress into different roles or operational duties. But there have been a number of reports over the past few years into workplace fatalities in the mining industry. And one key report made 11 recommendations. And of those 11 recommendations, three were to do with the quality of training and the quality of supervision, finding that there was a need to improve training and improve supervision to enhance what they refer to as safe production. And my industry partner put together a stakeholder group, and one of the stakeholders said to me, "Steph, we keep being told that we need to improve training, but we don't know how to go about it. And nobody's helping us to understand how to go about it." So there's no evidence base for the current approaches to training for the industry. And they wanted to know, what does good actually look like when it comes to learning and training in the mining industry? And in fact, they weren't using the word learning. They were just talking about training. What does good look like for safe production? So I was able to go to three remote mine sites in Western Queensland and interview 83 frontline workers. So these were people who lived for a week or 2 weeks on site. They work either day shifts or night shifts. They're operating lots of heavy machinery. They're working as diesel fitters. They're working as mechanics or electricians, supervisors, health and safety officers, environmental officers, managers. And we ask them about how they prepare for their job, what helps them to do their job well and to do their job safely. And they did speak about training, but they described training as being a very small part of how they learn. They describe training as being transmissive and passive and very compliance focused. What they said was the most powerful way for them to learn was on the job with their peers, that they learn from watching others, they learn from interacting with other people, they learn through mentoring, through deliberate practice, through feedback. And what helps them to learn in those environments are relationships, a feeling like they, one of them described it as, "I feel like they have my back." So, in a high-risk environment, when there is a potential for an accident or a near miss or a challenging kind of task, if you're not sure about what to do or you're worried about the implications, if you don't feel psychologically safe to report that, it can be a difficult conversation to have. So, feeling a sense of trust, feeling emotionally safe, feeling connected and a sense of belonging that you've got these strong relationships allows people to ask questions about their practice and to build greater capabilities within that work. Some of the key findings from that work, the overarching key finding was to shift the conversation from training to learning. And to us as educators, we might not think that's such a big shift, but for the industry, it was a huge shift because they hadn't really thought about where all of this learning is happening on the job. And how could we capture that learning and ensure that is really good quality learning? that what's being passed down through that tacit knowledge and that experiential wisdom is of the highest quality that it can be. So that's something we're interested in trying to better understand. We also discovered in this work, like I said, that the second key finding was around that learning is social situated and happens on the job. So I think a key finding from that that swaps over into education very nicely is that all learning is relational. Regardless of whether you're in a kindergarten classroom or you're operating heavy machinery on a mine site, learning is relational and learning is active. Learning is about doing and getting feedback and interacting and observing. I think another key finding from this work that translates across to the education context is that language matters. So, as I said, that overarching theme of shifting the focus from training to learning really is helping the industry to rethink what does learning look like, not just what does training and compliance look like. And I think there are parallels with education here when we think about what are we privileging and what are we preferencing in our language, in policy, and in practice. And in Australia at the moment, there is a very strong shift towards that more cognitively oriented reductionist view of learning. And while there are some really important constructs and concepts and strategies and practices associated with that, what I worry about with this is that by focusing and privileging the language around, or preferencing, I should say, the language around cognition, memory, retention, we're not preferencing and prioritizing the language around the role of emotions in learning and the role of relationships and culture and context. So I think language is something that we really need to pay attention to in the way that we're talking about learning, whether it be in the mining industry or whether it be in education. And I think the third thing that really translates across these two is the importance of knowing how to learn. That in an increasingly complex world of work, whether that be mining or more broadly, we're working on another project at the moment looking at an agile learning framework to support the crossing of industry and professional boundaries that so many people need to do in the workplace. And really, at the heart of that is the capacity to know how to learn and to be a self-regulated learner and to be a co-regulated learner and to be able to evaluate and monitor your own learning as you're going. And that was very clear in the mining work, and it's also so crucially important in an educational context as well, is that we need to be teaching our students how to learn, and we need to be promoting opportunities for the development of self-regulated learning and metacognition within that education context. And I think, in terms of leadership across the two contexts, the supervisory role in the mining industry is a huge role. And at the heart of that role is humanity and connection. And I'll jump into another question that's similar to this that you posed, which is around this notion of supervision and leadership. And I think our second paper in this work, which was looking at supervisor competencies, the title of that paper is a quote from one of the supervisors who described good supervision as involving passion, style, and smarts. And I still remember him explaining this phrase. He said, "I use this phrase all the time." And we were in this little site office out on a mine site, and we're all in our high vis and our steel capped boots, and we're sitting at this, he was at this whiteboard, and he wrote passion, style, and smarts. And he said, "What I'm talking about here is that supervisors need to have a passion for what they do. They need to love their work. They need to know that they are making a difference to their team, to their organization, and to the industry. And they need to bring to their work this passion for helping others to make a positive difference." Then he said, "Style. Style is about who you are, your dispositions, what you bring to the table, your experience, how you operate as a leader, your relationships with your crew. And smarts is your knowledge, your operational knowledge, procedural knowledge, your knowledge of safety and of policy and practice. He said a good supervisor must have all of those things. And I think that beautifully captures what good leadership in education also needs to have is passion, style, and smarts. And again, I think this, when we think about this in relation to the science of learning, we can just see so many overlaps there in terms of thinking, feeling, being, and meaning making. So as different as these contexts are, I see a lot of similarities in how people are learning and what helps them to learn and what the conditions are that promote learning in these different contexts.
One of the concepts that you employed was co-regulated learning. Can you talk a little more about co-regulated learning, both in terms of industry, but then also in terms of classrooms?
Yes, so when I'm referring to that notion of co-regulation of learning, I think this also goes back to that reciprocity and that relationality of teaching and learning, that learning is about giving and receiving. It's about hearing what others know, sharing what you know, providing insights, giving feedback, learning from. It even goes back to my saying of learning with and from others. It's that idea of being in this learning space together and supporting one another in recognizing what do we need to know? How can we go about learning that together? Or how can I go about helping you to learn that? Or how can you help me to learn that? How do we know if we're learning that? What would we do differently next time? So, using that kind of notion of planning, monitoring, reflecting, but doing it in a collaborative way and supporting one another's thinking in that process. So, I think it's important that we make that explicit and make explicit our shared responsibilities for supporting our learning and the learning of others. That some people do this quite intuitively, but not everybody does. And it's one of those, I think it was in your interview with Anne Marie, and you were talking about, Anne Marie's done so much work in this space of regulation and co-regulation, but you were also talking about the idea of noticing or with itness, I think you referred to it
With it,
as.
yeah.
Yeah. And that. Yes, we need to be noticing and aware of our own thinking and behavior and learning, but we also need to be noticing and recognizing and supporting the learning of others. And that doesn't matter whether it's in the classroom as a teacher working with a student or whether it is in the workplace with one another. And in fact, I think one of the sustainable, one of the factors that contributes to the sustaining impact of our partner schools program is that capacity of our teachers when they're working with us, we're co-regulating one another. But then when they go off into their schools, they're facilitating that co-regulation of learning, like a ripple effect across their whole school. And it's through that process that the learning and the professional growth is sustained. So I think it's absolutely fundamental that we bring this to the table, we make it explicit, we use this in the language, we prioritize this as a way to sustain rich and deep and meaningful learning.
There's one thing that you described in the conversation about
Fabulous.
thing.
Thanks, David.
There's a
time.